Good afternoon and welcome to A Look at the Arts. I'm Tom Lounges. My guest today is Thomas Dolby. He's perhaps best known for his 1980s MTV keyboard-driven hits like She Blinded Me with Science, Hyperactive, and Airwaves, among others. Thomas has also contributed his talents to a broad spectrum of songs made famous by so many different artists over the years, ranging from hard rockers like Foreigner and Def Leppard to fellow new wavers like Lena Lovitch and the Thompson Twins, to name but a few. Thomas Dolby is now a college professor and recently has authored his memoir, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology, for Flatiron Books. Listeners today are going to have a chance to call in to win a couple of hard copy books from Thomas Dolby. That's 769-9577. Wait for your cue to call in and win, and you might take a copy home of the brand new Thomas Dolby book, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. Since I mentioned Thomas Dolby had contributed greatly to the careers of fellow new wavers, why don't we go back to the very early years of his career? He was a member of Lena Lovitch's band. In fact, he wrote this one, which was a big hit for Lena. And then we'll get Thomas Dolby on the phone right after we unwrap this new toy. It's Lena Lovitch with Thomas Dolby. It seems we're having a bit of a problem getting across the Great Atlantic Divide here to call Thomas in jolly old England, so we are going to keep working on that. In the meantime, we're going to play a song going back a few years. This is Thomas Dolby, who will be with us in just a bit, and a song called Spice Train, as we spice up your afternoon on A Look at the Arts. What the fuck?
is like a garage sale, and I'm pitching my stall to cater to the infidels. The old jazz is gone, and rock and roll is nebulous. Those that survive clinging to the detritus. And if you roll with it, you can ride the spice train. When it boils down to it, you could hold the world in the palm of your hand. And the beat goes on from Bahrain to Brixton, from Beirut to Bruges, from Beijing to Boston. And if you roll with it, you can ride the spice train. When it comes down to it, you would trade all for one night in her arms.
Spice Train, Thomas Dolby, I'm Tom Lounges, and you are listening to A Look at the Arts. And we had a little bit of a snafu, a little bit of a problem getting Thomas on the line, but hey, we've gotten through. The ghosts and machine are gone. The elf on the shelf has helped us on this Christmas week. And Thomas, are you with us?
I am the ghost in the machine.
Oh, I'll tell you, this has been not the day, I'll tell you. Everything that can go wrong, it's one of those Murphy's Law kind of days. But we have you, and I'm happy that we can continue on now as planned. We've got a couple of copies of the new book to give away. Of course, the new book I'm talking about is The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. It's your memoir. Congratulations on the book, first of all. You just got that put out.
Well, I did indeed, and it's been a couple of years in the making. I was approached by a publisher to write a sort of tech guru book, and that didn't really appeal to me. It seemed like exactly the sort of thing I would hate. But it did prompt me to go through some old diaries and calendars and meeting notes and old Palm Pilots and Filofaxes, and it was kind of amazing reading. I'd kept them all the way back to the late 70s, and what was cool about it was you didn't know what the heck this guy thought he was doing, blundering into all of these areas and different parts of my career. And I thought it made rather compelling reading.
I was wondering if you had kept journals over the years, because your recollection on some of these events and your memories were so crisp and sharp, you almost felt like you were there watching you as a fly on the wall.
Well, yeah, the first draft of the book was in journaled form. I just pieced together the journal entries and meeting notes that I had. And my publisher persuaded me to put it in a sort of past tense, you know, first person format. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned at first that it would lose its immediacy if I did that, because I didn't want to write it with, you know, 2020 hindsight from a, you know, 2016 perspective. Mm-hmm. But he said, no, just stay in the moment and, you know, every now and then you can take a step back and give us some context, and it worked out pretty well.
You say a lot in just 276 pages. It's a pretty quick read that keeps the flow going, and that's a lot. You get 36, 37 years of history there to put into that short amount of space. Was it hard to do the editing? Obviously, when you do your first draft, as you said, a journal, you can, it's free-flowing thoughts, but when you got to fit it between two covers, that's when the hard part seems to start, at least for me.
Oh, the first draft is lots of fun. I mean, because you just do it stream of consciousness. Mm-hmm. They gave me a budget, really, for the number of words, and I figured out in the time that I had to write 1,500 a day. So I went and locked myself in a room each morning and wouldn't come out until I had 1,500 words, and I had a great time. Mm-hmm. The problem was I got to the end of the period and realized I was only a third of the way through the story. So I was kind of hoping they'd say, oh, Thomas, have you ever thought there might be two or three books in here? Unfortunately, they didn't say that, but I did eventually get it done. And the editing part was definitely hard. There was a lot of fact checking to do, and people have different recollections of things. So when I would get things verified by people that were there, you know, we each retain different parts of our memory.
There was a study here on PBS television that said people can actually believe things that never happened. They can psych themselves into thinking, I remember this memory, and it never even took place. So I imagine if you have several people in the same room for the same event, the recollections would be drastically different.
Well, I gave my first draft to half a dozen friends whose input and constructive criticism I felt would be valuable. And, of course, the first thing they wanted to do was fix themselves in the book. I was fortunate to have a very anal retentive English rock manager through the 80s, and he kept every single file and fax and email, you know, ever sent. So I knew he'd be able to sort me out on some of the dates and facts.
I really liked your opening. It grasped me right away when you were doing the retelling of working on the bus all through the night on demos for Michael Jackson. You gave us a feeling of actually being there when you got out in the payphone booth in the middle of the desert. We could feel the arid heat and almost see the cactuses in our minds as you were, you know, telling these words to us. That was such a cool story. Share a little bit of that story, since Michael Jackson is from right here in Gary, Indiana, where we're at.
That's right. So he is. Well, you know, what has happened was I did a gig at the Greek Theater in L.A., and Michael showed up unexpectedly with an entourage and came backstage. And he was in the middle of recording the Liberty album with his brothers. And he confided in me that his brothers had each brought in a couple of songs because everybody wanted to get a songwriting credit on the album. And they weren't all that great. And so he felt he was missing a couple of key songs and asked if I had anything lying around. I said, well, yeah, as it happens, I've got some great things lying around. He said, you got anything like Hyperactive? Because I really like that one. And I said, yes, it so happens. I've got one exactly like Hyperactive. In fact, I can put a demo together for you and send it to you from my personal computer. This is in 1983, remember. Mm-hmm. I had a Tandy TRS-80 with acoustic cups. And so I was determined to stay up all night making the demo in the back of my tour bus. When I finally finished it somewhere around Barstow, California, I made the bus driver pull over in a cloud of dust, and I waddled out to a payphone with my Tandy TRS-80 and my brown corduroy trousers with its pockets bulging with quarters. And I attempted to send a digital file over the telephone line to Los Angeles.
That song, Hyperactive, I've got that queued up. We're going to play a little bit of this. And this was the one you actually wrote for Michael, but he wound up not recording it. You did it and had actually pretty big hit with it, correct?
That's correct. In fact, in the UK, my home country, it's my biggest hit. It did better than She Blinded Me With Science. But yeah, I'd written it originally for Michael. I remember calling him after I sent him the demo for that one and said, so what do you think? And he said, well, I like the drums. And that was it. And I said, well, can I send you anything else? And he said, can you send me some ragwort for my llamas?
Wow.
Ragwort being a species of weed that grows in the Welsh mountains.
So no more music interaction there.
No more music. I never managed to get one off the ground.
Okay, well, we're going to play Hyperactive now. We'll be back with Thomas Dolby on the other side. And let's give away a copy of the book right now. First caller at 219-769-9577. 219-769-9577. First caller, you're getting a hard copy of The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. From my guest, Thomas Dolby.
Tell me about your childhood.
At the tender age of three, I was hooked to a machine just to keep my mouth from spouting junk. It must have took me for a fool, 'cause they chucked me out of school, 'cause the teacher knew I had the fun. Tonight I'm on the edge. Better shut me in the fridge, because I'm burning up. I'm burning up. With the vision in my brain and the music in my veins and the dirty rhythm in my blood, and I sing with my heart, and I sing with my heart, and I sing with my heart.
Hyperactive, taking you back around 1984. That is my guest, Thomas Dolby, a song that he originally wrote with Michael Jackson, hometown hero here in mind. But you wound up having a big hit with that internationally, and that one did well here in the States as well. So, Thomas, I think it all worked out in the end. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it all worked out for the best. And you know, I treasured my brief interactions with Michael, and there's a lot more about this in the book, including an account of an extraordinary visit I had with him at his home in Encino on a very rainy night in Los Angeles.
Hyperactive was the second hit here in America. And aside from the hits that you've had, including Spice Train, and you had Airwaves and a few others that did well here in the States, you have worked with many solo artists, I should say, other solo albums from other artists. Some of them kind of predictable, like Lena Lovitch, you wrote New Toy with, and you were in her band, and Bruce Woolley and all that. But then you went ahead and did like Foreigner and Def Leppard and these other artists. So I was kind of confused, not confused, but kind of interested in how some of those relationships came about.
Well, in the very early days, when I was trying to make the transition from keyboard playing sideman to solo artist, I would make demos and send them around to anybody in the music business that would listen to them. And one of my cassette tapes got listened to by a producer called Mutt Langer.
Ah, yes.
And he was actually busy producing a band called Foreigner, who I only really knew of as a sort of a fairly hard rocking band.
Mm-hmm.
But they said that they were making this album Foreigner 4, which included some very lush ballads, and that they needed some help with the keyboards on it. I was only 21 at the time, and I was actually working as a street musician in the Paris metro when I got a call from Mick Jones at Foreigner saying, could I fly to New York and work with them on the Foreigner 4 album?
Mm-hmm.
And they were already behind schedule, and during the day they were recording vocals with Lou Gramm. Now, I would come in at night. This is Electric Lady Studios in New York, and I'd come in at night with a relief sound engineer, and they'd say, well, we'll be back in the morning to see what you've done. So having never spent much time in a recording studio before, it was amazing to me to get a chance to play on songs like Waiting for a Girl Like You. And I was very very pleased with a sort of intro that I made for the song using my Mini Moog, which when I played it to the band, the bass player commented that it sounded a bit like massage music. But fortunately for me, the massage music made it onto the song, and so I felt very subversive and pleased with myself when a few months later the song did so well in the charts and I would hear it on American AOR radio.
Yeah, that went, I believe, to number one, Waiting for a Girl Like You, and you did some other songs on the album too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, I did the whole album. I did things like Urgent and so on. And you know, it started a very fruitful relationship with Mutt Langer, and Mutt was also the producer on Def Leppard's Pyromania and Hysteria, so I got to play keyboards on those as well. But I didn't want to be typecast with a certain type of rock band.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, if you look on the back of Pyromania, you will see that keyboards are credited to Booker T. Boffin. And this was actually Mutt's nickname for me, and I've got platinum albums on my wall at home awarded for over a million sales of Pyromania to Booker T. Boffin.
That's funny. I didn't realize. I knew you had done the sessions, but I didn't realize you went under a nom de plume for those.
Well, as I say, I didn't want to be put in a corner or in a pigeonhole at that point. But Booker T. Boffin sort of came to be a character that I identified with over the years. And I think I conclude my book by saying that, you know, after the various phases of my career in Silicon Valley and in mobile phones and ringtones and things like that, I sort of returned home to my roots in England and went back to being Booker T. Boffin again.
Wow. We've got a winner. Dwayne Davison of Valparaiso, Indiana, has just taken home a copy of The Speed of Sound, the Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology book, your memoir. And he would like to pop on and say hello. So say hello to Dwayne.
Hello, Dwayne.
How are you today?
I'm very well. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks so much. I have to say, going to college in the United States in the early 80s, everyone who is my contemporary, of course, would kind of have as an anthem, Blinded with Me with Science. It kind of brings you back to a very specific moment in time, and for me that was a great one. So honored to speak with you.
Oh, nice to talk to you too.
Are you?
And I was interested also in one of the previews talking about you being a college professor. I don't think we've gotten that far, but I'm interested in that story as to what you're doing now.
Yeah, that was an interesting career trajectory. How did that come about, Thomas?
You know, I come from a long line of teachers. My father and his father were all Cambridge dons. And my mother taught algebra at a girls' school. Most of my five brothers and sisters are pretty academic in one way or another. And I was sort of the black sheep of the family. I left school at 16 to go and work in a fruit and veg shop while I was funding my punk rock habit. So my dad would be very pleased if he was still around to know that I'd finally joined the family firm as a professor of the arts at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland.
How long have you been there?
Just about to complete my third year of teaching there. And I really enjoy it. And it's fascinating, really, teaching a new generation of students. Thing is, I never really had anybody to teach me with most of the stuff I was doing, because it was also brand new that there were really, you know, nobody knew how to do it. And so I had to feel my own way. But I feel like I've reached a point in my life where I need to give something back. And so this is a really good time for me to be, working, rolling my sleeves up and working with the next generation of musicians and filmmakers.
Are they familiar with your background, of course?
No. In fact, in many cases, it was their parents that talked them into taking my classes. They'd never heard of me.
Oh, wow.
So I was in Cambridge in 1984 going to school, and if there's one campus that might be beautiful, more beautiful than some of the colleges that comprise Cambridge, it might be Johns Hopkins. So you've been to some beautiful places.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Dwayne. I think there's little that can beat Cambridge. Pretty, though, it is at Johns Hopkins.
Right. But I don't know if Cambridge has the benefactor of Michael Bloomberg throwing billions to the university. That's a nice benefactor to have.
Well, that certainly comes in handy. And may I say, you're very well informed, sir.
Oh, thank you. Yes. So, I'm very interested in learning more about everything in the book. Sounds like some great stories and, of course, some tie-ins to Northwest Indiana, where we are now. So, but it's great to talk with you, and I wish you the best.
Thank you, Dwayne. Very nice talking to you.
All right, Dwayne.
Enjoy the book.
And Thomas, thanks so much. Take care.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling in, and you will enjoy the book. I guarantee that. It's a nonstop, you don't want to put it down kind of read.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Thomas, one of the things that I found interesting, you're talking about coming from a family of educators. I know that your father also was involved in archaeology, from what I understand, which is, of course, the study of the past. You, on the opposite end, were always looking to the future with this fascination for science, technology, and even sci-fi. If you look at some of the album covers and things you've written on, seemed like a strange parallel. Your dad looking at the past, you looking at the future.
You know, I mean, for most of the early years of my life, I thought my dad was just interested in dusty old pot fragments in museums. But it was only actually when I traveled with him to Greece and the Mediterranean that I came to understand that really what he was fascinated by was the stories, the mythology, the imagination, you know, the art carried down between generations of painters and poets and the oral history of the area and so on. And I realized that, you know, what floated his boat was very similar to what floated mine. He'd just chosen a different milieu from me. So in a way, I can see what we have in common there.
Mm-hmm. What sparked your interest in technology at such a young age? As you mentioned, there was no real groundwork for a lot of what you did. You kind of went by the seat of your pants and created things out of kind of MacGyvered it, as we like to say. What inspired that?
Well, yeah, I was always a tinkerer. You know, I went to a string of boarding schools, which got very boring after lights out. So I would be down my bed under the covers with a flashlight and a crystal radio set, listening to Radio Luxembourg or Radio Caroline. I was also the kid that was up at the top of the playing fields fiddling around with the meteorological station, you know, that looks like a beehive.
Mm-hmm.
I was the projectionist in the film club, and I loved to re-splice the films to make them funnier. I'd put a bit of the Tom and Jerry cartoon in with the war movie. So I was just always very hands-on, and I got the nickname Dolby because I was the first kid in school with a portable cassette player and a set of headphones. That was my sound system.
Wow.
It's this huge bulky thing in a leather case with a shoulder strap made by Philips, and I had a pair of Koss headphones with a curly cord on them. And of course, my cassette player had Dolby, had a Dolby button on it, and so that became my nickname.
When you were at the university, were you studying engineering? I'm trying to figure what you would have gone into at that point.
Oh, I never studied at university. That's the thing, you know. Oh. I mean, I was a bit ahead of my time. I graduated out of high school at the age of 16, and I was living in London and very keen on going to punk rock gigs and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I would basically earn a few quid during the day working at a fruit and vegetable shop, and then I'd go home and practice a bit and then go out to a punk rock show, and I'd see bands like The Clash and The Sex Pistols, and even people like Elvis Costello and The Police in those days were playing in pubs. And anybody that had short hair and straight trousers was a punk rocker.
You had mentioned your friend Brian Jones working at the fruit and veggie stand there. And mentioned he looked very much like Sid Vicious. Did he ever get a career? I know you taught him how to play bass. Did he ever pursue it? I never figured out if he succeeded.
Actually, he was a better bass player than Sid Vicious. but like Sid, I'm afraid he's no longer with us. And it was a little bit prophetic that you know, seeing as he was such a hero, that they both died so young in different circumstances. Brian actually got hit by a bus in the Marylebone Road, or a lorry, I think. It's very miserable, but it was sort of interesting because it brought home to me, never really occurred to me that my parents might worry about me living on my own in London at the age of 17 or 18 or whatever it was. But it was really, that was my first sort of brush with punk rock. And it didn't take me long to realize that punk rock was not really for me. I mean, socially, it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But shortly after that, I discovered my own people. And there was this sort of underground electronic scene bubbling up in the basements of London pubs and clubs. And the guys there had anoraks and acne, and they would watch bands like Throbbing Gristle and Cabaret Voltaire and so on. And that didn't grab the headlines the same way that punk rock did.
Right.
But to me, it was a lot more, it just clicked a lot better with me.
Well, you came along at just the right time. They say timing is everything. And, of course, you had a unique product, a unique sound. And, of course, MTV and music videos were the hottest thing in pop culture, just erupting all over the world. And we all remember your mad scientist persona in the video for She Blinded Me with Science. And you mentioned early on that you would do a lot of film editing. Were you involved in the production, direction, and creation of your own videos?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw videos as an opportunity to break through via something other than radio.
Mm-hmm.
I recorded my first album, and it got very well reviewed and well received, but it didn't get much radio play, and it sold about 3 copies. And when MTV first came along, I started to notice that if you had a successful video on MTV, didn't matter whether you were getting radio play or not, you could still have a hit in the charts.
Right.
Because MTV, you know, in the early days was so influential that radio programmers were paying attention to it. Club DJs were starting to, you know, cross over and play, you know, European music, start to play synth pops in the pub and things like that. It became an alternative way to break through. And I saw that as a creative challenge, because I'd always been into silent films, you know, people like Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin and so on. And I really saw a 3-minute music video as an opportunity to make a silent film with a soundtrack to it.
A lot of artists I've talked to from that era said that they didn't really like having to make the video, but the labels was a necessary evil to them. But you seem to have enjoyed working in the medium.
I definitely enjoyed it early on. You know, I think the window of time where music videos were very creative and a real expression of the artist's desires only really lasted about maybe 10 years at the outside. And then after that, you know, music videos became very formulaic and predictable. And in any case, a lot of the music channels were no longer showing music videos. They were starting to get into reality TV and things like that.
All right. Well, let's play that big hit for him here on MTV, Blinded Me with Science. We're going to give you a chance now to once again call in and win a copy of Thomas Dolby's brand new book, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. And this is coming to you courtesy of Flatiron Books. We'll be back with Thomas Dolby right after this. Stay with us. Science. Thomas Dolby taking you back to the 1980s, the MTV era there. Thomas Dolby is my guest today here on A Look at the Arts. We are promoting his new book, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. It's a memoir, and George, who was calling in from work and had to whisper, out in Crown Point is our winner. So we don't have George on the phone, but George said, thank you, Thomas. He's looking forward to reading it.
Well, that's fantastic. I love the fact that he had to whisper because he's at work.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not supposed to be listening to the radio, but I love Thomas Dolby. Did I win? I'm like, yeah, you did. Hyperactivity and Blinded Me with Science did very well here in the U.S., as we've discussed, but you always seem to have a greater success at a greater audience base outside of America. Is that fair to say? Looking from the outside in, it seems that way to me.
You know, I had success in different countries, some of which are no longer even countries. I remember one place where they were expecting my record to go number one in the following week's charts, and then there was a military coup, and they didn't publish the chart. So I've always been a bit unfortunate from that point of view. And I always seem to get good news mixed up with bad. I actually remember one night when I was terribly, terribly sick in a hotel in New York City. My manager called and said, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that you got number one in Canada. The bad news is that you've got to pack up, check out now, and catch a plane to Los Angeles because they want you on live TV tonight. And I did that suffering a terrible fever. I was in the throes of mononucleosis. This is one of the stories I relate in the book.
I remember that. And you met the guy at the airport and he said, I'm the guy that discovered you.
That's right.
I thought that was funny. It's like, yeah, you're meeting him for the first time. Hi, I'm the guy that discovered you. I thought that was so classic record label of that era.
There are dozens of record label executives that discovered me. Same way as I think the first gig I ever did in the Marquee Club in London, there must be at least 1,000 people that were at that gig if you read their tweets and Facebook entries. But in fact, the capacity that night, I think, was about 200.
It's funny. Even, you know, I grew up in that era as well, breaking into the business at the MTV era. And when you look back at some of the debauchery, I guess you'd say, from the business sense with some of the record people, it's no wonder that everyone went indie.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, there was a time when major record labels were a necessary evil.
Right.
You know, that was the only way you're going to break through, getting the radio, getting the shops. But as of, you know, the early 90s, that was no longer true. We were all making music on computers now, and our fans had the same computers, and now they're connected by the internet, and you could compress a file down as an MP3. It was only a matter of time before the major labels lost their stranglehold.
Right. Now, you still write and record. About 6 years ago, I interviewed you for your then-new project, Map of the Floating City, which was actually, as I recall, like recorded in three segments, and you kind of combined them. There were three different mindsets, which was pretty unique at that point. Are you doing anything at this point, something new that we can look forward to as far as music?
Well, you know, because I've been teaching for the last 3 years, I've been fairly immersed in that. And it hasn't left me a whole lot of time, you know, to do any new writing. I think it's about time. And I feel also, to an extent, that seeing as I'm supposedly teaching film music composition, it's been a good few years since I composed a film score. So I really feel if they don't want to consider me a total fraud at Johns Hopkins, I ought to do another film score and start to get up to date so I can actually, you know, be talking from first-hand experience.
Mm-hmm. Might be a good project to do with some of your students.
That's a very good idea as well. The problem with students is that you get to the end of the semester and they just sort of evaporate.
Something else when we talked last time you were doing was an online computer game. It was tied to the Map of the Floating City, as I recall. Are you involved in anything like that, designing games or doing music for the video games?
Well, this is actually something we want to start teaching at Johns Hopkins as well. So there's a music conservatory at Johns Hopkins called the Peabody Conservatory, and it's actually the oldest in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
It's founded in the 1850s, I believe. And so it's along the lines of a Juilliard type of a school, but and so very well respected, but like any school, it needs to be firmly grounded in the 21st century because there just aren't enough seats in professional orchestras for all the great musicians they turn out.
Right.
So conversely, a lot of opportunities are opening up in TV and film, obviously, but also video games, virtual reality now, and then also research related to geriatrics or stroke victims. These are all things that we're in a position to offer a degree in at Johns Hopkins, which you certainly couldn't do at Juilliard or a traditional music school. So I'm trying to steer the university in that direction in offering degrees that cover new media.
We were talking about recording some new stuff. You haven't had time to write at all over these past couple of years, or are you just kind of sitting on stuff?
I write in my imagination.
Okay.
It's a hard thing for people to sort of understand, but I write when I'm going for a walk on the beach or driving in my car or standing in the shower, I'm able to sort of create complete songs in my imagination, really. And then when I sit down at the keyboard, it's just a sort of formality to work out the notes and the chords and the sounds. That said, I tend to work backwards from the moment at which I present or I perform that song to an audience for the first time. So, you know, for example, I will visualize a dark stage with an empty spotlight and a grand piano. Mm-hmm. And a guy walks onto the stage, sits down at the grand piano, and starts to play an intro. What does it sound like? When he starts to sing, what's the melody? What are the words? And then I work backwards from that moment and sort of reverse engineer it. Now, if I don't actually have a booking to go do a gig, or if I don't have a record label that is, you know, I'm contracted to make an album, if there's no sort of sucking sound, as it were, then very often I'm not very productive. I tend to steer my creative energy in a different direction.
So you're like a slave to the deadlines.
It's not that so much as just there needs to be a creative outlet for what I'm doing, okay, or else I'm not very productive.
Now, when you were sitting down to write The Speed of Sound, the new memoir, was that a satisfying thing for you, as to the point where you see yourself as writing other books down the way a bit?
Well, I really enjoyed the process. I mean, especially the initial stages of it, where I was pretty much just, you know, parsing my diary and journal entries from the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. I've always kept up with those, and I've had yellow pads, and I've had Palm Pilots and Filofaxes and Apple Newtons and things, where I've made just taken random notes on a day-to-day level. And I was approached a couple of years ago by Flatiron Books to write a sort of a music tech guru type of book. It didn't really appeal to me, perfectly frankly.
Right.
But it did prompt me to go back and reread some of my old journal entries. And what I found compelling about them was that, you know, I'd had the meandering course through two or three different industries, the music industry and then Silicon Valley and then the mobile phone industry. And when I wrote these notes, I had no idea of the big picture. I was just completely in the moment. So as you're reading this guy's exploits in these areas, we now know what I didn't know then.
Right.
So
right.
You probably want to wring my neck half the time going, you know, why did you do that? Or why did you trust this guy? You know, and I thought that was actually more interesting than a sort of music guru book.
Right, right. You show many sides to yourself in this book, and you keep it all very fresh. And like I said, in the short amount of pages, 276 pages, you squeeze a lot in, and there's no filler. It's all a lot of great stories and color.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been lucky enough to lead a very colorful life, and I think because I've always been a bit of an oddball, my contemporaries, my peers in the industry, were very curious about me. Mm-hmm. And this actually carried over when I moved to Silicon Valley in the 90s. Because I would meet these tech wizards at these, you know, Silicon Valley computer companies, and they could still remember, you know, as Dwayne mentioned when he called up a while ago, that when they were in college, you know, they would be at MIT and they would remember the girl they were dating when she blinded me with science was on the radio.
Right.
So they would invite me in for these meetings to show them what I was working on, and they were curious about it. And they sort of finish up the meeting by asking, you know, if I could snag them a Rolling Stones ticket when the Stones come through next month and are playing at Oakland Stadium.
Right.
So I was a sort of token rock and roller in Silicon Valley for a while.
Okay. Is there anything we haven't touched on, Thomas? We're down to about a minute and a half here. Anything that we've not covered?
I think a lot of people didn't know about my career in the tech industry. It's actually, there are a lot of young tech geeks that know about me from my work at Beatnik and never heard my music before. Mm-hmm. I formed this company, Beatnik, at the beginning of the 90s, and the goal originally was to add sound to the internet. And we did that in a very innovative way and had lots of downloads and subscribers, but they were paying $0 per month and we had a revenue of exactly nothing.
Mm.
So we only really hit pay dirt when Nokia came along about 1998, and they licensed our technology to embed in their phones to do ringtones.
Mm-hmm.
And ringtones, you know, it was hard to get people to pay 99 cents for a song
right.
on the internet, because they could get them all free from Napster. But they're quite happy to pay $2.50 for a bleepy ringtone of the same thing. So there was actually a business to be had in that area. Yeah, we made the synthesizer that got embedded in over 2 billion phones. At one point, two-thirds of the new cell phones being manufactured had Beatnik technology in them.
Keep up with Thomas Dolby at www.thomasdolby.com. All you need to know about Thomas is there, and perhaps you'll be touring again soon. It'd be nice to see you on the road.
Well, it'd be great to get out on the road. Maybe if the university gives me a sabbatical, I could do that.
There you go. Well, congratulations again on your book, The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology. Thomas, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thanks a lot, Tom. It's been fun.
You have a great holiday.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
An interesting guy, to say the least. Thomas Dolby on A Look at the Arts. Well, I've got just a few minutes left, so let's squeeze in a final song. And what better way to wrap up a show than with this farewell song from the 1992 album Astronauts and Heretics. Thomas Dolby and I Love You. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Tell you.